This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
We talk a lot on this program about how investors often flock to the safe haven of U.S. bonds. But what if the United States were to lose its status as the safest place for the world to entrust its money? Today, Wall Street pondered that thought, and it wasn't pretty. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Ally Bank, offering sleeping money alerts to notify customers when their money could be doing more. Learn more at allybank.com. Marketplace Innovations Desk is supported by Jaguar. You can experience the 2011 Jaguar XJ at a local dealer or visit jaguarusa.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for taking time out from your tax day this Monday, the 18th of April. Beyond the obligation many of us fulfill today, investors have been handing Uncle Sam a lot of money and expecting a steady return. The potential side effects of our mounting deficits have lurked mostly in the background. Until today, when Standard & Poor's lowered its outlook and warned it might cut the country's rock-solid credit rating if squabbling politicians don't agree to slash the federal budget deficit. The Obama administration cried foul, saying the ratings agency was playing politics. And what did the markets think? Our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore reports.
Sometimes it hurts to be reminded of what you already know. American Treasury bonds have been set for years as one of the safest investments in the world. So for months, the U.S. has been pushing the snooze button on a trillion-dollar budget deficit, until S&P stormed in today and told us all to wake up. Here's Ward McCarthy. He's the chief financial economist at Jefferies, the investment bank. He said the only surprise from S&P was the timing.
This basically was just telling the U.S. that you've been profligate for long enough and you have to start getting your fiscal house in order. This is not a new story from the rating agencies, but what S&P did was turn the heat up a notch.
It got pretty hot. The Dow Jones Industrial Average took a 200-point hit in the morning and never fully recovered. Jim Sarney is the managing principal of money management firm Payden & Riegel. He says today's markets are a glimpse of the future to come until Washington nails down a lasting budget deal.
We're going to see a lot more choppy markets trying to work through the implications of a downgrade and what that means.
The ratings agencies may be giving Washington the push it needs to stop talking and finally cut the deficit, says Douglas Elliott. He's a former J.P. Morgan executive, now at the Brookings Institution.
They've given us a year or two's leeway here and said we need to be seeing action by 2013. That's a lot of time for us to actually do something. And if we don't do something, we should be downgraded.
If the U.S. is downgraded, the government would have to pay more to borrow, which would, of course, increase the deficit even more. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
A lot of people would like to invest in hot tech companies these days, Facebook, Twitter, Groupon. Since they aren't trading shares publicly, though, only well-connected investors can get a piece of the action. But it seems their private club is about to be invaded. T. Rowe Price just divulged it owns nearly $200 million worth of Facebook shares, and it's put those investments into some of its mutual funds. Here's Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith.
Private shares of a hot company are like Wall Street's version of a golden ticket. Jack Ablin is the chief investment officer for Harris Private Bank.
Companies like Google come to the public markets, their stock prices explode, and the early insiders make a fortune.
Companies like issuing private shares because they can raise money without all of the expensive regulations and financial disclosure that comes with going public. The appeal for investors? Investment economist Gary Schilling.
going to a cocktail party and say, well, I'm in a mutual fund, I got my piece of Facebook, probably has a certain amount of sex appeal.
Sexy, maybe. Smart, hard to say. Mutual funds have started dipping into private shares because investors are excited about them. T. Rowe Price also owns shares of Twitter and Angie's List. And all of that exposes them and their investors to more risk, says Georgetown finance professor James Angel.
You're at the mercy of the company to decide how much, if any, financial information to give you.
T. Rowe Price told Marketplace that Facebook shares make up a tiny fraction of its enormous portfolio, less than 0.5%. And anyway, it's Facebook. Isn't that a pretty good bet? Harris Private Bank's Jack Ablin says, well...
It just reminds me of that Groucho Marx line that said he would never join a club that would allow him to be a member. When Wall Street is offering these shares to individuals, chances are the party's pretty much over.
In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
And we'll have the details behind those Wall Street jitters we told you about when we do the numbers. Like you really need to hear this one again. It's tax day, and if you're still scrambling, you have until midnight to get right with Uncle Sam or file for an extension. Apropos of this community exercise, we started wondering about tax rates. There are no shortages of stories about the super rich paying next to nothing for taxes. But has the burden eased for the rest of us? To answer some of our tax rate questions, we've called upon Joseph Thorndike. He's director of the Tax History Project at the Nonprofit and Nonpartisan Tax Analysts. Joseph, good to have you with us.
It's great to be here.
When we talk about the tax burden, most people, I think, point to the policies enacted under former President Ronald Reagan as the reason that it's been easing over the years. Does he deserve all the credit?
He deserves a good share of the credit, although it's a long-term process in which most of us have seen our taxes drop at least a little bit. But, you know, the big number sort of obscures some of the important smaller numbers. They've dropped quite a bit more for some groups than they have for others.
Now, there are no shortages of stories out there about the super rich paying next to nothing, but you're suggesting that across all brackets?
Well, there's been, I think it might be fair to say, a modest decline across all brackets, but there's been a particularly big decline for both ends of the spectrum, for very low-income taxpayers and for very rich taxpayers. For those at the bottom of the income spectrum, it's, you know, they've done pretty well. The bottom quintile of taxpayers paid an average rate of 8% in 1979, and that dropped to 4% in 2007, which is the latest year I have numbers for. But for the rich, they've also done quite well. The top 1% had been paying at 37% in 1979, and their rate dropped to 29.5%. You can even get more granular than that if you look at the top 400 households. Their rate dropped from 26.4% in 92, this is a somewhat later number, to 16.6% just recently.
And what about the Bush tax cuts? What were their impact?
Well, the Bush tax cuts were good to most of us, especially those of us with kids or, really almost everyone. You know, so for some people, the decline starts earlier in, say, you know, the Reagan years. But there's a big anti-deficit push in the 1990s that begins to nudge rates back up. And they don't start down again until the first Bush administration.
Now, what about the tax on the super rich? I've heard that that was up to around 90% during the Eisenhower years.
It was over 90% during the Eisenhower years, even higher than that during World War II. And actually, those very high wartime rates stuck around for all of the 50s and into the 60s. They start down in the 60s, but only into the 70% range, and then they keep coming down. So at the very top, the rates were very high, and they've gradually come down quite a long way.
Now, I think it's safe to say that there's a reluctance on Capitol Hill to tax the super rich. The politics have changed, maybe on both sides, but in the Republican Party, commitment to low taxes among them, how is that working out?
Well, I think the Republican Party today is quite a different party than it was in, say, the 1970s or even the 1980s. There is a real commitment to limiting taxes and to tax rate reductions, and perhaps less of a commitment to deficit reduction. It used to be that Republicans, who have always been suitably enthusiastic about reducing tax rates, were more afraid of unchecked red ink. I mean, that fear may be returning now, but I think for the last 20 years or so, we've seen a politics where deficit worries just did not quite rise to the level of importance that rate cuts did.
But the bottom line on this tax day is that we can all take at least some consolation in the idea that we're paying a little less than we had been.
A little less than we had been, and probably quite a bit less than we're going to be.
Joseph Thorndike is director of the Tax History Project at Tax Analysts. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
A lawsuit over global warming is guaranteed to heat things up tomorrow at the U.S. Supreme Court. The justices are set to hear oral arguments in Connecticut versus American Electric Power. It's all about the right to sue power companies over their greenhouse gas emissions. And as Sarah Gardner reports from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, the High Court's decision has the potential to embolden or stifle climate change litigation in this country.
This case pits a coalition of states and private land trusts against some of the country's biggest coal-burning utilities. In 2004, the plaintiffs sued the power companies under federal nuisance laws. Bruce Myers at the Environmental Law Institute simplifies it for us.
They're saying you, the power industry defendants, are emitting greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide. That is contributing to climate change, and we're suffering injuries from that.
Injuries like flooding and rising sea levels. They asked the court to impose limits on the utility's CO2 emissions. A lower court dismissed the lawsuit, saying global warming emissions were a political, not a judicial matter. But in 2009, a federal appeals court stunned the power industry by reversing that ruling. Industry is now asking the Supreme Court to decide.
The critical question in this case is who sets climate policy in this country? Does Congress do it? Or do the courts?
Ed Comer is an attorney at the industry group Edison Electric Institute. Comer says if states and private groups win the right to file nuisance suits over global warming emissions,
utilities would be subject to multiple and potentially conflicting climate standards. We are now subject to standards that are being set by EPA.
Well, sort of. Since this lawsuit was filed in 2004, the EPA has started to draw up greenhouse gas regulations, but it hasn't limited how much CO2 power plants can spew every year, yet. And congressional Republicans are trying mightily to make sure it never does. David Doniger, an attorney at the Natural Resources Defense Council, says that uncertainty is why this lawsuit must go forward.
In the battle to stop global warming, this is the ultimate backstop. If a hostile Congress were to block EPA, the states and the land trusts, they need some place to turn for relief.
If the Supreme Court rejects that argument, legal observers say it will put global warming litigation in the deep freeze. That includes a closely watched case in Alaska. The native village of Kivalina sued 24 energy companies for over $400 million in global warming damages. Rising sea levels have eroded parts of their town. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Coming up, a year since the BP oil spill in the Gulf, and many still wonder, why start drilling there in the first place?
The United States Geological Survey concluded that America would be out of oil by 1935.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average declined 140 points, or 1.1% to close at 12,201. The Nasdaq shed 29 points, a little more than 1%, to finish at 2735. The S&P 500 gave back 14 points, that's 1.1%, to end the day at 1305. As we told you, Standard & Poor's fired a warning shot about a possible U.S. credit rating downgrade. That sparked heavy trading and a broad sell-off in energy and industrial stocks. Chevron leaked out 1.2%. ExxonMobil fell 1.4%. Bond prices ended higher despite the S&P warning. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.38%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a program in which rates are determined by the driving habits of policyholders. Learn more at progressive.com. by Chevrolet, undertaking a carbon-reducing effort, investing in projects like wind farms and planting trees across America over the next few years, on the web at Chevy.com. And by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price. Invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department releases new residential construction data for March. President Obama holds a town hall meeting at Northern Virginia Community College. Deficit reduction is on the agenda. And he was nominated for an Oscar for his portrayal of the title character in Arthur. Actor Dudley Moore was born on April 19, 1935. He would have been 76. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon, in for Kai Ryssdal. This morning, I used a plastic toothbrush, a plastic hairbrush, and I grabbed a plastic water bottle. And I just used a plastic pen to edit this story. As a rule, most of us have come to think of plastic as bad, something that does lasting damage to the environment. But it's more complicated than that. Susan Frankel writes about our relationship with plastic in her new book, Plastic, A Toxic Love Story. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Let's start with a little history first. Plastic, evil to the environment as we know it today, but it was actually created to help preserve natural resources and animals, like the elephants, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. In fact, one of the first early plastics, celluloid, was developed in response to an ad by a billiard ball maker because billiard balls were made out of ivory, and there were widespread fears in the mid-19th century that so many elephants were being hunted that they soon wouldn't have the ivory they needed for the balls. So they offered $10,000 in gold for anyone who could come up with a good substitute. And John Wesley Hyatt answered the ad and developed this fantastic substitute, celluloid, which, as it turned out, wasn't so great for billiard balls, but it turned out to be great for lots of other things, you know, from combs and buttons to Cupid dolls and more.
Fast forward to today. How dependent upon plastic are we? I mean, as I pointed out earlier, I use plastic things more often than I don't.
Yeah, that's right. We are completely surrounded by plastic. And, you know, our consumption and use of it has just continued to rise, particularly in the last 50 years. So that, you know, in 1960, the average American consumed about 30 pounds of plastic. Now it's 300 pounds a year.
Now, you trace plastic's history through different products, the comb, the Frisbee, the IV bag. Why that in particular?
Well, I use the IV bag to talk about plastic in medicine. And, you know, in medicine, plastic is kind of a double-edged sword. The invention of a plastic blood bag was a huge and revolutionary impact in medicine. It really changed the way blood banking worked and made it much more feasible than it had been in the past. But the material that it's made out of, vinyl, leaches chemicals that are hormone disruptors. They interfere with testosterone and can affect the way that bodies develop, particularly if infants are exposed.
Now, that's a pretty common thread through all this, though. It does have its important uses, but there's also a downside to plastic and the harm it can cause.
Plastic is great stuff. I do not demonize plastic, and I don't think we ought to. The problem is that we've used it all too often in foolish and short-sighted ways.
Yeah, here's a quote from you that I think says it all. We take natural substances created over millions of years, fashion them into products designed for a few minutes' use, and then return them to the planet as litter that we've engineered to never go away.
Yeah, that's right. And isn't that crazy? About half of all plastics go into disposable items. And again, some of those disposables are great things. I mean, boy, you wouldn't want to be in Japan right now and not be able to get your water from a plastic water bottle. But does that mean that, you know, all of us need to be carrying around water bottles and buying our beverages in throwaway plastic bottles every day?
So what's the balance? How do you modify our relationship with plastic to make it less bad for us?
Well, I think one place we start is by recognizing, again, that these are valuable materials and really thinking hard about where it makes sense to use them. Disposable items, that's a modern invention. It's brought great convenience. But again, sometimes that convenience comes with a huge cost. And I think we need to be asking ourselves, when is that cost really worth it? When could we go back to using something that is more reusable?
Susan Frankel's new book is Plastic, A Toxic Love Story. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
The worst oil spill in the nation's history started pouring into the Gulf of Mexico 1 year ago this week. The explosion of the Deepwater Horizon oil platform killed 11 people. And enough crude to fill maybe 10,000 or more average-sized swimming pools gushed into the deep, dark sea. This week, we'll be heading down to Louisiana to check on life after the spill. And later in the week, the quest to replace oil in consumer products. Today and tomorrow, we're focusing on why BP was drilling 2 miles underwater in the first place. Seems all the easy stuff has been found, and the search for new oil is tough, expensive, and risky. Yet the true believers in the oil sector say they're up to the task, and they've got the track record to prove it. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong reports now from one of our hydrocarbon capitals, West Texas.
In 08, the government warned we're running out of oil. 1908, oil historian Diana Hinton.
The United States Geological Survey did a survey and concluded that America would be out of oil by 1935. While they were wrong...
This is the story of I Told You So. Time after time, West Texas oil drillers have proved the skeptics wrong, proved the oil companies right. In fact, Hinton lives in Midland, Texas on Staniland Avenue, as in Standard Oil of Indiana Avenue, just off Gulf Avenue and Shell Avenue. And in these parts, folks are whispering that B word again. Boom.
And picture perfect here on a Thursday night.
The local rodeo charges $5 a head. That's pocket change to Zach Nolan. He rents trucks to oil drillers for Texas-sized margins these days.
I go on vacation quite a bit. Montana. I really like it up there. Been up there. Hawaii a couple times. I like it. We're going to Puerto Rico next week, so next Friday we're leaving.
His buddy Jack Gardenhire owns trucks too. But when they break down, most local mechanics are out, drilling.
They don't make nothing what they can make out in the oil field, so you're going to have to wait, you know, at least a month to get any of your trucks worked on.
To put this in perspective, consider the terrain here. Take a map and draw a line down kind of the middle of Texas.
West of there, it don't rain no more. Okay.
Local boy Bobby Weaver is the author of Oil Field Trash.
And so it's very dry. The sand tends to blow. Everything grows has thorns on it.
The joke is God felt sorry for this place, so he gave it oil. They just had to find it. It wasn't easy for early drillers like Carl Cromwell. In a 1970 interview, courtesy of the Permian Basin Petroleum Museum, Cromwell said in the 1920s he had no technology, no geology.
Well, we had no geologists. Nobody knew anything about anything. It was, they didn't know limestone from concrete.
But in May 1923, Cromwell drilled, and the earth gushed.
Hallelujah!
A hallelujah well, as they called it. The local Catholics even christened the well, dubbed it Santa Rita, patron saint of the impossible. And still, two decades later, the "we are running out" messengers came knocking again. World War II allies were burning through American oil. Here's Amy Myers Jaffe at Rice University.
You know, the U.S. Department of Interior in 1939 had a declaration that we had 8 years left or 5 years left of resources in the United States, and we all know how ridiculous that turned out to be.
Cue the next rebirth, the West Texas sequel. Local geophysicist Patrick Whalen.
And that's when seismic technology came along, and seismic technology enabled people to see into the earth. And that's what kept the oil industry going.
West Texas provided a quarter of the country's petroleum to power the post-war economy. By now, specialized engineers and geologists ran the show. Though author Bobby Weaver says the old-school drillers didn't always take to the geeks.
They just felt like these overeducated types were infringing on their bailiwick, so to speak.
In the 1950s, the peak oil sirens went off again. Mark Ellis heads the company Lynn Energy.
The easy finds have been had. All those high prolific reservoirs have already been discovered, and they're still producing, but on the tail end of their maturity. Is it tough oil? Yeah.
American production did finally peak in the 1970s, but Ellis says there's still a lot down there. It's harder and expensive to get, but if prices stay up, technology will provide. It always has. Take the Chevron facility, an industrial spaghetti of pipes and connectors, as a single job, to squeeze more oil out of an old hole. A hole full of rock, says Chevron's Mitch Mammalidis.
People think there's a cavity down there, and there's not. The oil and gas exist in solid rock, denser than the concrete on your driveway.
The brainy solution? Flush carbon dioxide down and force up the oil with the help of a few pump rigs. It works. But that's not the biggest deal here in Texas. The hydrocarbon superhero of today is a man named George Mitchell.
They thought he was nuts. Even people on his own staff thought he was nuts.
Historian Diana Hinton says Mitchell tried to coax oil out of a thin layer of shale rock. It's called fracturing. You drill a hole and fire a cocktail of water, sand, and chemicals to crack the shale, and the oil escapes.
It took them 17 years to do it, but Mitchell was right.
There are fears that fracking pollutes groundwater, and once again, there are warnings the oil drillers' luck will eventually catch up to them. Steve Kopitz is with consultancy Douglas Westwood.
Yes, you can increase production somewhat with better technology and high oil prices, but you can't reverse geology forever.
The industry response? Yeah, we've heard this before. 1908, 1939, 1956. As long as the world wants it and will pay for it, we'll go to the ends of the earth, into rocks, 3 miles below the ocean, wherever. We'll figure it out. Trust us. In West Texas, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Manta.com, providing an online destination for small businesses to be found and to find new customers. More online at Manta.com. By Constellation, supporting customer choice and clean, efficient energy sources and technologies, working with customers nationwide to create a sustainable energy future. Constellation.com. And by Putnam Investments, offering total return strategies designed to match your goals. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note, the Volkswagen Beetle is getting a makeover for only the second time in its 73-year history. Just don't call this the new Beetle. That's the name VW gave to its first redesign back in 1998. This new version has a less curvy, more squeezed look, along with an upscale interior. Now, 60% of Americans who bought the car last year were women, and the German carmaker hopes to dump the chick car image to make it a more attractive boy toy. So brace yourself. The flower vase next to the steering wheel, which has been an option since the original Beetle, is no longer being offered. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow declined 140 points, or 1 1/10%. The Nasdaq shed 29 points, a little more than 1%. The S&P 500 gave back 14 points. That's 1 1/10%. Our producers include Abishai Artsy, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Eng. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And next time on this program, getting the go-ahead to extract oil from foreign soil isn't easy. It definitely involves jumping through some hoops.
The number of the hoops and the character of the hoops change with the price of oil.
I'm Bob Moon. Hope you got a refund, and hope you can join Kai back here tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.